We're about to get started for the next session. Once again, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank all our sponsors, Thomson Reuters, SmartStream RDU, Anna, FinTech Finance, One Market Data, Stifel Europe, Itiviti, and Exact Pro, many of whom are outside there in the exhibit hall, as I'm sure you've seen, and we'll be around for coffee at the end. So please continue to network after the next two sessions, wherein we will hear about approaches to best execution and connectivity in a multi-venue environment. And the venues are becoming increasingly multi by the sounds of things. And then at 11:30, we have a panel looking at the SI landscape. As I mentioned, we have just completed some research around that. We've got a couple of papers, in fact, that we've done on SIs. So we'll be reaching out to you about access to those later. If you would like early access, please drop your card at reception, 12:10 or thereabouts, coffee and networking, and who knows what after that. Good. Okay. You never know. So first panel up is on best execution and connectivity, multi-venue environment. I'm going to hand over to my good friend Ian Salmon, director at Ignite G2M, who has helped me and the team pull this event together today. So thanks to Ian. Over to you, mate.
Right, good morning. Good to see a lot of familiar faces here. We heard a lot from the leaders panel. Surprisingly, actually, I thought that what some of the reflections early on are that how super political this process is, and actually we're going to take it a little bit down into the real world here, in the sense that day to day people have to actually work and live and trade on these different places and actually make sense of what's going on, and how does that actually happen on a day-to-day basis. So we're probably living through some of the most dynamic times we've seen in terms of new types of venues, new functions on those venues, so periodic auctions, instruments capped out, then reinstated, and the data we have to consume and report to justify our choices to our clients or our end consumers. So for this panel, we'll focus on the where, what, and how of ensuring best execution and connectivity in a multi-venue environment. I'm joined on the stage by a vast amount and quite a varied amount of experience from across the broken community. So I'd like to just start by asking each one of you to introduce yourselves very briefly to the audience. Start with Thomas.
Hi, my name is Tom Kennedy. I'm the Global Head of Analytics at Thomson Reuters. I look after platform and regulatory solutions. Part of my responsibility over the last 3 years has been to look into the best execution and SI regime and build our responses in terms of product offerings.
Hi, I'm Joe Everett. I'm Managing Director for Select, which is Stifel's electronic trading product in Europe.
Hi, I'm Chris Lewis. Until recently, I was the European trader for Magnetic Capital, who are a large multi-strat hedge fund.
Hello, I'm Dermot Harris, and I'm Global Head of Regulatory Solutions for One Market Data.
Hi, Will Winslow. I work for Redburn, who are one of the largest independent agency brokers specialising in liquidity access. I run both the trading technology team and the analytics team.
Fantastic, thank you. Okay, so if we turn first to the question of we've heard a lot about from the leaders panel about new venues, or at least sub venues within existing infrastructures and existing liquidity pools. As an executing broker, I think I'd like to turn to the practitioners amongst you to start with. What do I have to do in practice differently since MiFID II go live, and how's that evolved over the first 8 months or so? So. Probably best, Will, start with you.
Yeah, I think as we touched on in the last panel, one of the biggest challenges for us is just keeping up with the sheer connectivity and the level of technology needed to support all these new markets. I think it was touched on briefly that whether that makes it competitive or not, given the, such a high barrier to entry, is possibly for another discussion. The sort of the big change that we're seeing, the big challenges are a massive growth in conditional pools, which started to grow towards the end of last year, but have really taken off and continue to grow sort of every time we look at the numbers. We're also seeing a big use in grey, so large in scale orders hidden on lit order books. We find that gives a good kind of a mixture of what we can no longer get in the midpoints, but without having to cross the spread as we would for interacting with an SI or something like that. The big winners for us have definitely been the periodic auctions as well, and the conditionals.
And perhaps Joe.
Yep, sure. So we take a little bit more of a logistical view of this. We stepped back. We could see all of the venues that were coming into fruition within specifically the UK market. And we stepped back from that and went out to our clients. We sort of said to them, okay, look, we're going to get you access to these venues. It's not an issue. But how do you want to access them? How would you like to access them? And in all reality, which of these do you think suit your order flow? So we took a beta test in so much as, you know, we have a trading desk within Stiefel, and we would run a lot of our testing out of the results that would come off of that desk. So we had a really good hands-on approach to the new venues. And yes, we are, you know, connecting clients to more venues than we ever did before. And we're doing that, you know, from a point of view of, you know, working closely with them. And we'll provide them with advice. So our role as traders and sales traders and salespeople has evolved just as much as the venue environment, multi-venue environment that we're in so much as we're now holding hands a bit more. We're working a lot more closely in partnerships with our clients, you know, to help them through this, plethora of venues that are out there. And as Will said, you know, we're not finding anything specifically different to very many people yet. Periodic auctions is definitely benefiting. We are interacting with both bank and ELP SIs for certain clients. And again, we're finding them, you know, we're finding some interesting results from them. And we're also seeing maybe it's a function of the low commission rates and keeping everything cost effective, but we're seeing quite a growth in the closing auctions on the lit markets as well. So.
Okay. And perhaps Chris, coming from the sort of more of a consumer buy side perspective.
Absolutely. Initially, we didn't actually make any changes. It was just a wait and see approach. So just to see what venues would come into play, what functions the sell side would offer us. Initially, when you look at the periodics, I was personally quite skeptical, but they have proven to be more successful than I think a lot of people were thinking at the time. I was also looking at other sources of new liquidity, which I say new. Retail flow is an example, being it's not new, but it's definitely an untapped source of liquidity, especially in Europe, which is notoriously difficult. And I think there's some houses who are looking at that flow and are giving us definitely good access to that particular flow. I also think there's excuse me a second. I've never done this before, so please bear with me. I also think we need to look at I've gone blank. Please,
no,
get
fine.
Someone else.
So,
apologies.
So we've heard a little bit from Will, and what I'd like to sort of dig into a little bit more from Will and Joe, particularly, and then we'll open it up to Thomas and Dermot. Is from a real practical point of view, you know, coming on a, this might sound very simplistic, but you're coming on a Monday morning and actually, you know. A real world example of this is the double volume caps. You've had a complete change of the scene, as it were, and although you might not have the choice, or you might choose not, you know, to implement something immediately, the expectation is that you're going to react immediately to, you know, new liquidity or to a change in the market seemingly overnight. So in practice, what does that really mean? How does it affect the systems you use? How do you actually deal with that on a day-to-day basis? Because it's great looking out a year or 6 months or a year and looking at the way that the market might change, but actually, you know, down at the trading floor level, you've got to implement that. So how does that really, really impact you?
I think the key thing there is when you're sort of building out that connectivity and the technology stack is making sure you have that flexibility inbuilt into it. That when you're deciding whether or not you go to a dark MTF or not, that's not just a factor of whether or not the dark caps are in, that's a factor of the type of order you're getting, of how big it is, whether there are sort of specific instructions coming from the client. And once you've actually built a system that you can fit all of that in, it kind of almost naturally has to account for things that a market goes down, a dark volume cap comes in. So it's quite interesting, on the last panel we're talking about how some people seem to have very fixed routers that even ahead of the dark volume caps coming in, we were seeing a reduction on the amount through the MTFs. I can say that's certainly not the case where we are, that we will react to where we see the volume and where is the most effective place to trade for a given order. If there are people out there who are using kind of fixed distributions across these markets, I'd be very surprised, and I'd certainly hope that kind of increase ahead of the caps is more people trying out these new venues, seeing what they are, than until you get that data, until you have experience with the markets, it's really difficult to know how they're going to react and how they're going to interact with it. And in terms of new venues coming along, I think you always need to have an open mind about what those venues are. Our approach will generally be to look at a new venue, to kind of assess it in a very qualitative way that, yeah, I think as some people have mentioned before, does it fundamentally make sense? Given that it makes sense and we think that it might be useful, what sort of flow do we think it should interact with? What's the opinion of our clients? Do they want us to include that venue? And yeah, is it economical? That I'm sure some clients would love us to interact with certain amounts of flow. If we tell them that that costs 10 times their normal commission rate, they're unlikely to want to go there anymore. But we definitely need... I think every broker, every practitioner out there needs to keep an eye on what new venues are appearing and how the markets are evolving. Even now we're, 9 months after MiFID II, things seem to have settled down in terms of the SIs, the periodics. Now we're seeing the next wave of venues coming out. So we're seeing a lot more focus around RFQs coming out from TradeWeb and the like. We're also seeing several brokers, Joe included, looking at ways that we can interact with retail liquidity and combining that with institutional liquidity in an effective way. And I think it's really important to monitor those, to keep an eye on them. If you can interact with them on a very controlled basis to get the data, you need to do that, because without that data and without the understanding about how it works, there's no way you can properly control the way you route.
And you talk a lot about the data, and I'd like to bring Dermot and Thomas into this level. So we know that there is, it's not so much an information asymmetry as a dearth of information on which to base things at the moment, but going forward that information will become more and more formative in terms of what your strategies are and how you deal with them. What are you seeing in terms of the adoption of that that data? Are people already thinking about how they're going to use it within their algorithms, within their analytics? And is there a symmetry between buy and sell side in the interest in that data? So maybe to Dermot first.
Sure. Well, I think the data is key. A lot of what I've heard in this panel so far and in the previous panel about new and innovative markets and centers and techniques, a lot of it's new names for old stuff. I've actually not encountered anything in Europe yet that hasn't been tried before, or there aren't some facts about it. So it's not so much that it's all innovative, it's more that there's a lot of it coming quickly in Europe. And a lot of participants are going to struggle to make any kind of informed decisions without tools to comparative tools. And it's fundamentally hard in Europe because there are so many of some of these venues appearing. So the ability to do comparative analysis is very important. And the data to do comparative analysis is extremely important. And it's largely missing for some of these, in some of these areas right now. You know, I've taken a look at the RTS 27 data that's appeared. It's nice to have some data, but it's very messy. You know, trolling through millions of ISINs is not easy for everyone to do. And there's little of it so far. So I think there are some, you know, larger sophisticated firms who've been trading for a while, banks who can afford the data, have good data resources, and they have an advantage there. Many of the small firms that we deal with are struggling greatly with the data side of things. How to get data for benchmarks, if you're trading derivatives, and even for the lit markets, like just how to get market data that you can afford for lit exchanges. And I was very impressed that Natan Tiefenbaum, the previous talk, mentioned data, and nobody else did, and I thought that's really important because for some of our customers, the cost of data is a huge deal. You know, it's very painful for me to have a conversation with a client who naturally wants to benchmark his trading in stock, something liquid like that, against a European EBBO, and have to say, you know, having to process the data for all the exchanges and then pay all the exchanges to construct a BBO is just intrinsically very expensive compared to a single venue view. And some of our smaller customers have to make do with lower quality data and less of it to make their choices, which naturally will be less informed choices, simply because of the cost of data. So I think data is key. The data that we're seeing so far from RTS 27 is very messy. I'm sure there'll be more questions about that we can address later. And the data is expensive. And I think these are significant issues.
Thomas?
Yeah, so I pretty much agree with what Dermot has said. I kind of expand into the non-equity area because I think this is where, you know, MiFID has introduced some enhanced requirements from the market. You know, areas that we've seen, you know, we market data, we've seen about 27 plus new venues kind of sprout up and happen to register as MTFs or OTFs, and you know, that's excluding the SIs, which kind of, I think, the count is about 133 or that way, given the ESMA register website. All of these sources, you know, there's mass fragmentation of content. You know, I think aggregators, even, you know, firms like Thomson Reuters, it's a tough challenge. You know, we have to onboard all of that in a timely manner so that you can distribute and aggregate it. So I think the aggregation cost and the fragmentation is still there, and that's not easily addressable. You know, I think that there's, you know, even at the data that's visible, there's internal data challenges. So being able to acquire internal data sources for benchmarking, you know, prices that used to be dropped on the floor because there was no need for benchmarking. So that cost is now, you know, kind of, I think, risen up, you know, and it's very transparent now. You know, we've often heard that there's going to be the technical haves and have-nots. And that the, you know, the ability to respond in a technical way is as nearly as important, you know, as your business model, which is obviously very important, but that's going to be a real gotcha. You know, reference data, you know, can't be underestimated either. Tagging and identifying types of liquidity, trade flags, trade qualifiers, waivers, deferrals, you know, the timeliness of the data, you know, it goes on. You know, there's bonds, you know, which are being published, only about 5% of bonds are liquid, are defined as liquid, that you see any kind of real-time visibility in. So a lot of that kind of derivatives data, non-equity asset classes, is going to be seen, but it'll be seen, you know, far later. And then just the question, is it useful? You know, when you look at best execution, the types of benchmarks that you need to apply for some of these asset classes aren't the same. You know, analyzing a slippage for an equity that's traded on a central limit order book is very different than, you know, a derivative being traded via RFQ. The types of market mechanics are very differently. So I think that the types of analytics, the lack of market standards, you know, it's a very confused industry. And I think it differs then too, you bring in the complexity, very different from the buy and sell side, very different challenges. You know, there's, you know, so I think the industry's finding its feet, you know, and I think that standards will emerge over time, but you know, it's very much a technical and data issue.
So do you see it becoming, I mean, from a sort of maturity point of view, clearly we've got an understanding to do of a shifting market, and things will presumably begin to to standardise at some point? How far off are we from that?
You know, I think there's some banks that and buy sides, you know, all different types of participants. You know, there's the firms with deep pockets that can absorb that cost and respond effectively, and then there's the banks that can't, and the very, you know, kind of cost, there's a cost challenge. And I do believe that there'll be a degree of consolidation, you know, across some of the smaller tier firms. You know, I do think that there's going to be big impact. You know, I think that, yeah, so I think, you know, it's hard to know, but I do think that the more content that you have, or the more data that you have, the more business decisions that you can make, because you can analyze the types of liquidity to know where to trade and how to respond and how to shift your business model. So even though we look at this from a regulatory perspective, you know, in terms of meeting regulatory requirements, there's a business question to be answered too, which is, how do I adapt my business? And the data is definitely needed, and technology, tools needed to be able to analyze that information.
I think maybe, Joe, if you can, it'd be interesting to hear how that might be happening within your organization.
Okay, yeah, sure. It's quite scary, actually, the amount of data that's coming into us these days. But once we do this, we like to take it back, just strip it back. Okay, you can take as much data as you like. We can send rockets to the moon. But my client wants to trade in a passive environment, in something low impact. They'd like to trade large in scale if they can. So, you know, whilst previously we were probably all judged on the outcome, you know, what was the outcome of the trade? Nowadays, that sort of pathway to getting there starts a lot sooner with data. So you're collecting data, a lot more data now on the pre-trade. So we're looking at the impact, whether the market was moving before the trade actually came into the market, then what was happening post-trade, at the time of the exact time of the trade and post-trade. So we're collecting a lot more quote data around what we do. And, you know, clients are benefiting from that because we can talk to them about the ways of, still trading in the way that they want to trade, accessing new forms of liquidity without necessarily having to be tied down in too much data. Okay, I think having lots of data doesn't suddenly mean you're going to get great execution. It gives you a decision. It gives you the ability to make decisions about that. And, you know, we take the point, we don't have the resources to necessarily collect, data across all of the fixed, across all asset classes. We're looking specifically at equities, so I can kind of only talk about that. But certainly from where we stand, we actually have less clients asking these days for post-trade analysis because they're having to do it themselves. You know, MiFID II brought that in. As a broker, we were providing masses of post-trade execution data, TCA data, and that almost closed overnight. Suddenly, you know, a broker providing TCA on their own trades was kind of taken away from us, which in all honesty was something that's probably quite a good thing for us to then concentrate on working with them. On more of their venue choices and getting to new points of liquidity. I think I think there is more data. We're using it wisely, but we're looking at how we use it in terms of the systems we give clients access to, and certainly retail trading and the platform that we've built on that side was built largely on the data, because you need to be able to prove, benchmark against other exchanges, how you are performing. If you're going to bring something new to this market, you need to have the data to back up what that venue or what the execution result you are achieving for your clients, and to be able to put that in the context of the wider environment with regards to all the other venues that they could access.
So
you say that clients have been taking all their data and using it internally. I know a lot of buy side have been switching the responsibility to the sell side, just to ensure they have full efficient processes, because that onus is on the sell side. When you're talking best execution to your clients, the sell side then has the responsibility. As a trader or as a buy side house, why would you want to do all that extra additional work when you can just put the responsibility onto the sell side? It's common sense when you think about it, but it's the easiest way of doing it. That being said, from the buy-side houses that actually make changes, not just have this vanilla setup, they're the ones that will probably outperform in the long run, because they're looking at tweaking their algos, they're looking at different venues, they're looking at different ideas. I'm working with their sell side counterparts and educating internally and externally just to ensure they have the best routes possible.
So there's been, I mean, one of the themes from the first panel was, you know, there seems to be satisfaction with the amount of innovation in the sense that, you know, people are having to adapt. I don't think there's no standing still in this market. Matthew made the comment from the buy side that it makes sense. Does a venue make sense? Is it good for me? But actually, one of the things I noted was, you know, from a size liquidity point of view, it really depends on the type of order. So when you start to look at, if we look down at quite granular level, at what needs to be done in order to offer that service to a client and offer that in a quite a dynamic way, because you're clearly seeing new venues, you're seeing new order types and that sort of thing. What does that entail, Will, from the point of view of, you know, the technology?
I think it's obviously a huge overhead in terms of the technology, just, you know, the amount of connectivity you need, the amount of data processing and everything else that goes with it. There's also a huge investment just in terms of sort of people and understanding that if we're connecting to 100 different venues or order types or anything else, to actually know how they fit into a wider strategy, we need to understand exactly how they prioritise different types of order, what our benefit is to resting a fractionally larger order compared to going to multiple other venues. That's a huge amount of effort of people spending a lot of time really digging into the details, speaking to these venues, understanding how they work, understanding their roadmap. Are they going to add new order types? Are they going to sort of drop support? And always sort of forward thinking. So I think it's important to look at it not just as a technology investment, but also a sort of a people and an understanding effort. And I think as Joe touched on earlier, a lot of what we're having to do as a broker now is not just understand that ourselves, but have to explain that to our clients and to the buy side. That they will often come to us with decisions of, I don't want to interact with SIs because they've heard of it or their own analysis suggests they're bad. Once we actually drill into that, we say, okay, what types of SI don't you want to interact with? Do you mean investment banks? Do you mean ELPs? Okay, you mean investment banks. What about this investment bank where we know we're just interacting with their risk book? And it's very important to be able to go into that level of detail that although you get sort of very clear requirements from your clients, they're not always fully thought through or fully well understood. That, you know, we have a lot of clients who do have that level of understanding, and it's great to sort of work with them and go through that. There are others who need that helping hand and need that guidance, and I think that's becoming a much more important part of what we do as a broker, of just helping people to navigate it both technically and in terms of understanding.
I think probably what Will speaks there about is kind of like the barriers of entry really for a provider on the sell side these days. If you're going to come into this market, you need to make sure that you have the resource to provide those types of customizations and to have the resource internally to do this. You need the desire, you need to be around, you're going to need to be around for a long time. You can't build something like this overnight. So that was something that we looked at and when we spoke to our clients, you know, coming into the environment almost 10 years too late. It's very, very hard. There are still a lot of buyer sides out there that do not have the ability to connect to multi-venues because they have a core broker list of 5 or 6 brokers that takes a board meeting, an execution meeting, a compliance meeting, a legal meeting, you know, somewhere along the line, you're going to find a hold-up as a fairly new entrant to the market. So there are barriers to entry, not only for the sell side in terms of providing services, but also for some of the buy side to actually adopt these venues. So, you know, we can act as a consolidator, but also we took a fairly new approach on the sell side, which is we engage with some of our sell side partners as well, whereby we will interact with Algo Wheels, which is fairly unusual for a new venue to come and say, you know, it's fine as a sell side competitor, you know, we'd prefer to keep this liquidity to ourselves. Our view is, look, in this day and age of multi-venue environments, there's still people that don't have the budgets to have more than 2 or 3 broker providers. And that's just a fact. When you're speaking to these clients, they don't. So So how do we do it? Okay, I connect to these five or six brokers. Right, fine. Let's have a grown-up conversation as brokers and see if we can become part of your infrastructure through them. We work with them. That way you are relying on their smart order router making decisions as to how to interact with you as a venue. You know, clearly you have benefits when someone comes to you directly, which is, I think, the SIs are probably facing the same sort of issue. You know, an SI would love to see your parent order. Give me your parent order, I'll be able to give you a much better service, rather than having to react to trade with your order via a bank's smart order router or via your electronic broker's smart order router. But the commercial reality is, can you do that? I've been out to see more than 7 or 8 SIs in the last few months, and I've spoken to each of them. They each have different ways of controlling their central risk books. They each have different views on how they're going to make prices in, you know, Euro Stoxx 60 versus FTSE Mid Cap and all the rest of it. So it's important that you understand the confines that you work in, and also getting to see your counterparties. And again, that comes down to some resource, but there are still some high barriers to entry for this. And I think, you know, again, you know, these are the sort of the complexities that we'll work through, let alone the political complexities that were, you know, talked about earlier.
Just to add to that, some additional colour. You have to remember that historically the buy-side would have a broker list of 100 plus brokers. That had to change, mm-hmm. MiFID II ensure that, especially with the unbundling. So your pressure from the top level to reduce your broker list is extreme, to say the least. And you also have your PB relationships, depending on your funds, and if you've got unmanaged accounts, you do get pressures, to say the least, to ensure that you route orders in the correct manner. So yeah. Just to add a little bit there.
So we're probably reaching time. So are there any questions come through yet? No. And are there any questions from the audience so far? Quiet. Right. So the last couple of minutes. So turning back to Dermot and Thomas. So we're hearing that. Clearly, there's a lot of intellectual challenge going on. How do I re-engineer things within my brokerage operation to service my clients, to enable the technology to interact with potentially moving target when it comes to different order types, different types of venues, different types of flow. What are you seeing? What are you guys seeing from the point of view of the end consumers, the buy side, looking for the data that they're going to use in order to benchmark these guys? How standard is their thinking? And how interactive are they being with you to tell you what they need from that data?
I'll take it first. So actually, I think there's I think one of the things that we haven't really touched on is the pre-trade workflow, which is becoming very, very important from a buy side. So instead of actually looking at a post-ante kind of analysis and looking at TCA as a tool, I think firms are looking at very proactive, you know, at the point of decision-making, can I make an optimal decision? And I think that kind of optimized decision-making is becoming at the forefront. You mentioned algo wheels, people looking to augment human buy-side trading with kind of AI. I know it's kind of a buzzword, but it's things like trade schedules, you know, kind of inform me, you know, given my risk parameters and how quickly the timeliness I want to get trades done, help me to kind of make the best decision. And I think there's, you know, that's a real focus area. And I do think it's one of these innovative areas that, you know, we talk about innovation, that, you know, can, where there is real activity of innovation and best execution. I think the post-trade benchmarks and some of the analysis that's been done is, you know, it's pretty old, pretty well established, you know, through academia and the industry itself, defining what these benchmarks are. So I definitely think that, you know, pre-trade and that's, I wouldn't say it's a cheap activity, because now you're consuming real-time data and you need more real-time consumption. So there's a cost between, yet again, you know, I think it's a consistent theme across, you know, the panels, is that, you know, as much as, you know, we went out to kind of meet investor protection, there was a cost of the intermediaries, and they kind of, the supply chain got, you know, heavily affected. And so, you know, do the costs outweigh the benefits? You know, but I definitely think that, you know, these tools implemented in the right way can drive down cost. So it depends on how strategic you are with technology, and how much of a how much technology factors into your business. I think every industry now is hasn't been touched by technology, and automation, and using data to drive down maybe people cost, supplemented with new forms, you know, or new aids to inform a decision.
Yeah.
Is it?
Well, I was happy. So I'll speak more generally than just the buy side. I mean, it's very important to the buy side, but actually, better tools, better tooling for execution quality monitoring has been big across the sell side and the buy side. And I was happy to hear you, Joe, say that you, there was less call now for TCA reports coming out from the brokers. You know, as a vendor of neutral products to the buy side and sell side, of course, that makes me happy. I think the themes that we've seen are, for the large banks, a huge diversity in views on how to do best X and how to do monitoring, and that's kind of driving a lot of innovative work by us, but it's at a high cost because everyone's got their own view about every venue and about every type of trading activity out there, and it hasn't standardized yet. So that's one thing that we see. And then for the buy-side firms, yes, benchmarks is the question that always comes up. How do I get the benchmarks? Where do I get the benchmarks? Are the benchmarks any good? And the answer is often no, they aren't. And certainly based on the initial dose of data we've got from RTS 27 and 28, they won't be soon. Hopefully they will get better. So benchmarks is key. You mentioned pre-trade, and that's key as well. That you know everyone wants to know how to use these venues better and where to direct flow. But the problem is even pre-trade depends on benchmarks, historic benchmarks. And so that's what's missing. And then for the small brokers, the unfortunate thing that we've seen, so our observation as a vendor, is that we try to sell, you know, RTS reporting bundled with great tools for figuring out your execution quality relative to others. And what we're seeing is, no, I've just got a report, and all my effort is just make sure I'm reporting something, I don't care what, so long as I'm reporting it, I'm just not even going to look at your, you know, execution quality monitoring tools, not yet, maybe next year. And the cost pressure on top of that means that there's this feedback loop where at least the smaller venues often are not doing good quality control themselves. They're just focused on reporting something so they don't get into trouble. And that contributes to the messiness of the data that we're seeing reported because there's a lack of care and attention. And it's probably not helping the buy side who are routing their flow through some of these smaller brokers. So very, very... it's very, very much in flux at the moment.
Reporting, I think that's another one for another day, but there you go. So we're up for time now, so I don't know if there are any questions from the audience now. But I'd like to thank the panelists. I think we've teed it up nicely for Jeremy and the guys to come in and talk a bit more about specifically the SI landscape, which I think has driven a lot of our thinking. We wanted to steer away from specifically looking at that here. But anyway, like you should show your appreciation for our panel.